Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics. I'm Em Clark. This is a bonus episode because I'm joined by the comic artist and creator Streff, who has created a new graphic novel, The Silence of the Unicorns, which we'll be talking about in a few moments. But before that, it's a very warm welcome to aka Stephen White. Welcome, Stephen.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Now, friend of the pod, Tony Foster, put us in touch, and we're going to be talking about your new book, which is on Kickstarter at the moment.
Yes.
But before we do that, I ask all my guests for their own comics origin story, what their first experiences were with reading comics. What were their first comics? Tell us about that.
Oh, well, my first look at comics ever, I suppose, would have been, I used to visit my granny's house as a little kid, and my two uncles obviously used to stay in the house, but when they moved out, they left all their old annuals and comics and things. So there was a room in Granny's house that was filled with like Ur-Willy annuals, Bruins annuals from like these original ones from like the 50s and 60s. There was like a Superman annual from there, from that sort of period as well. And there was a Tintin book. So going to Granny's, I used to go up there every week on a Sunday. I used to disappear upstairs and no one would see me for hours because I'd have my nose on all these old annuals that my uncles had sort of left behind. And things like the Ur-Willys, they were great. It was old Dudley Watkins, you know, the original artist on Ur-Willys. It was the real good stuff, you know. But it was Beano annuals, Beezers, Toppers. It was just like, 8-year-old's dream.
Yes. You know?
Never want to leave the room, you know. I used to stay there and she had a feather bed. So for me, you know, I've got this sort of nostalgic memories of lying in the feather bed reading these amazing books, you know.
Fantastic stuff. And you mentioned a Tintin book. Do you remember which Tintin volume it was?
Yes, it was The Secret of the Unicorn.
Oh, okay. How appropriate.
Yeah, it kind of stuck. Something must have stuck. And I still actually have it, because when my granny passed away, I did, a lot of her stuff had been actually thrown out by the time I managed to get to it, but I managed to salvage a few of the books. So I still actually have that, and it's the first printing of the English version, actually. But unfortunately, a lot of the other stuff went in the bin before I got a chance to get to it. Which is kind of sad.
You know? Yeah. Okay, well, how did you get, because you've had quite, you know, you've worked for a number of fairly big British comics, some of the biggest, in fact. How did you become a comic book creator yourself?
Well, like I said, when I was young, reading all these books, I mean, ever since then, I just drew and drew and drew, and that's all I ever really wanted to do. And my mum was a cleaner at the time working in an office, and she used to bring me home like big wads of paper from the office. So I had like a non-stop supply of paper to sketch in. I'll get her into trouble here. So yeah, lots of practice as a kid, just drawing. And when I was 16, I actually left school. I didn't go to art college or anything. I joined Edinburgh District Council as a YTS, which a lot of people might not know what that is. It's a youth training scheme. So basically, the council would pay you something like £35 a week, and you would, you know, work in an office. Basically, it was clerical sort of admin work. But my school teacher, my art school teacher, when I left, I think I'd left a day before my higher art prelim or something. She was quite gutted about that, and she gave me some advice. She says, well, no matter what office you go into, leave some artwork lying about, leave your drawings about and stuff like that. So I did that when I eventually went to the council. My first boss, incidentally, there was actually Irvin Welsh.
Oh, right.
Before he actually sort of had his fame and everything, just before Train, I think it was when he was writing Trainspotting. But the office I went into after that, they worked quite closely with the graphic design group. And I'd left my drawings sort of lying about. They'd seen them and they'd taken them to the graphic design group. And I ended up doing sort of half days of my YTS in the graphic design group. So I kind of got an on-the-job training. So I was working drawing cartoons for council leaflets, big exhibitions that the city put on. I would do drawings for those. I think I was there for about 3 or 4 years, just producing illustrations, cartoons for just a massive variety of events and all sorts of things. I mean, worked on exhibitions like Gold of the Pharaohs, which was a huge exhibition in the city in the 80s. But would also draw little cartoons to tell people to, you know, put their dog poo in the bins and things like
right.
that.
Right.
It was just anything that came up to do with council stuff. I was drawn for all that kind of stuff. So it was a real nice on the job training. You know, I was only 16 when I started there, and everything I did was getting printed or, you know, published in some way. So it was, you know, in a way, very different to maybe going to art college. I liked it. It was a really great experience there, you know. 7 designers around me that were all professionals, you know, just getting advice from them and stuff. So a little different.
And from there you went on, as I say, you've written or you've drawn for some of the biggies, haven't you? Tell us about some of the comics you've worked on over the years.
Yeah, well, from the council, when I actually left there, it was a little while before I started writing to actual comic companies and stuff. And I did send some samples into DC Thompson, into the Dandy. I think it was maybe about 4 years after I'd sent some samples in, I actually heard back from them. The guy that eventually became the editor that I worked under there, Morris Heggie, he said he'd had these samples and they were things of, they were like drawings of Tintin and established characters and stuff. I didn't have my own characters or anything. But he said when he looked at them, he wasn't sure if I was tracing them or not, or things like this. You know, so he just kept them in his desk for 4 years and not contacted me. So basically one day they were wanting to revamp one of their old characters, Winker Watson. They wanted to give him a bit of a facelift. So I got a sort of letter from DC Thompson, just inviting me to come in and chat with them and maybe potentially start drawing strips for them. So I got myself on a train up to Dundee, and that was me working for DC Thompson's for, I think, about the next 16 years.
Fantastic. And that presumably, you did the Dandy. Did you? Was that when you were doing some work on Commando as well?
Well, most of my work, so I had like 2 runs with DC Thompson. I worked mostly on the Dandy to begin with, a little bit of work on the Beano as well. I did do a Commando cover. The only time I ever worked for Commando was I drew a cover for them, basically because they were on a tight deadline, and I think the entire Commando staff were off sick. And they needed, and nobody could find the cover for the next issue. They needed right. it the next day. So I got a call at like 8 o'clock at night saying, can you give us a cover? We need it for tomorrow morning, kind of thing. And unfortunately, I was actually in Aberdeen doing, I think I was painting a Peter Pan picture onto Waterstones that night. So I didn't get home till like 10 at night. And then I had to read this Commando script. Just to get a gist of what the story was. And it was one of those things where you just got to pull an all-nighter, you know.
Yeah.
And but they had their cover and by 9 o'clock, you know, sitting waiting in the email inbox. It's one of those mad things that happens, you know. But it gave me a Commando credit as well as the, you know, the other Beano and Dandy stuff.
And also you mentioned in your origin story, you know, you used to read Oh, Willy and the Bruins. And I'm right in thinking that you've done some for them as well.
Yes. My first run, like I said, with DC Thompson's lasted for about 16 years. As I say, mostly on the Dandy. But as we know, the Dandy went out of print a few years ago.
Yes.
Unfortunately, a lot of my work went with it. As I say, I was mostly producing Dandy work. So when that happened, I actually went away and did other things for a few years. And then DC Thompson's sort of had the idea of bringing the Dandy back, but digitally. So it would just be online, and it would be like a motion comic. So it's slightly different. You know, the characters would be partially animated, still drawn as like two-dimensional drawings, but on different layers, so that their arms could sort of just do slight movements and things like this. So I came back to DC Thompson's for that. I think it was quite an ambitious project, and it didn't really take. And I think the digital dandy only ran for 13 issues online, I think. And then that itself as well just ended. And at that time, I moved over to Urwell in the Bruins. Not drawing the main strips for the Sunday Post, but doing other things, because they would appear on lots of things, you know, in annuals, newspaper competitions, spot the differences, just basically working with the characters with a view to maybe taking on the two strips in time. So that was about 3 years. I was just solely drawing Rurley and the Bruins characters, which for me was even more fun than the Beano and the Dandy for me, because, as I say, when I was a kid, it was mostly Urwilly, really. It was a big one for me, you know.
Yeah.
Even over the Bruins. I would read the Urwillies at my granny's house, and then go and fish and try to guddle fish and things. And my granny lived up sort of Pentland Crescent way, and I would go to the Braidburn Valley and try and guddle fish, you know, Urwilly style, things like this, you know. Trying to emulate Urwilly. So it was really nice to actually work on those two heritage strips, you know. So yeah, I did about 3 years of work on those after the digital dandy sort of went by the bye.
Amazing to end up drawing on a strip that you read in your granny's bedroom. Yeah,
fantastic. Yeah, it's following the footsteps of one of my absolute favourite artists of all time, you know. So it was great. I did so many things. Like I did some designs for the statue that's of Urwilly that's actually sitting in Dundee now at Albert Square. We did a project with the Bay City Rollers. We did an animated video for one of their songs. Just so many other wee things that they get involved with, you know, other than just the Sunday Post strips.
Yeah.
It was a real interesting time, you know.
And when did you start doing your own graphic novels? When did that come about?
Well, my first graphic novel that I ever had published was called Milk. I think it was published 2009.
Right.
But this was stuff I'd had drawn just in my own time for years, and just been sort of sat in the cupboard kind of thing. So I actually drew my first graphic novel, all the work that was in that, way before I even went to DC Thompson's. Already had all that stuff. So I think in 2009, I just approached a publisher with it. I had all these little short stories, basically, with like sort of future shock endings. So maybe only 3 to 5 pages long with a wee twisty ending. And I decided just to put them all together and sort of make a concept book out of them, and then try and, you know, find a publisher for it. So that was taken on and published in 2009. I subsequently self-published a slightly different version of it a few years later. And just a couple of years ago, a slightly altered version of that was published for a third time by Shoreline of Infinity. They took it on. I'd had the rights to it back for quite some time, and it had just been sitting in the cupboard kind of thing, and Shoreline came along and said, oh, we'd quite like to publish Milk again. So each time it gets published, there's a chance for me to sort of re-look at it and rework it, and it's kind of my Blade Runner. You know, there's all these different versions of it. So this is the director's cut, and this is the final cut.
So another unicorn connection.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's got three different versions, but it's finished now.
And you've also done you did an adaptation of Peter Pan in graphic novel form, which I think is the one and only version of Peter Pan in graphic novel. Is that right?
I think there may be other ones.
Oh, right, okay.
I'm not exactly sure. It was definitely the first UK one.
Right.
I think it's there's been like French ones, but they're not actually the Peter Pan story. A lot of people have taken the character and done their own things with it and things like that. So mine was actually taking Jane Barry's book and doing a real faithful adaptation of his original story, because I felt like Barry's Peter Pan is kind of lost in all the different adaptations that are out there. You've got all these films like Hook and just so much Peter Pan stuff, but Barry's words, these beautiful words and these phrases and from the actual book, I thought it'd be nice to actually use these and bring his original vision sort of back. In the graphic novel, all the text, all the dialogue are Barry's words. I didn't basically change anything. I just basically adapted it and sort of edited it. Obviously, can't put everything from a novel into a graphic novel. So it was a case of just going through his book and making it workable into sort of graphic novel format. But it's as authentic and as faithful to his book as you could possibly get, you know. So it's bringing his darker vision of Peter Pan back, you know. So the idea was also to sort of de-Disneyfy it, you know.
Yeah.
Because everyone's sort of first experience of Peter Pan is Disney's movie, you know.
Sure.
And he's got little pointy ears and he's kind of like an elf. And all that's just kind of nonsense, really, to be honest. You know, it's not who Peter Pan is and what the story's about, you know. Disney have a sort of habit of that, just taking something and just, you know, doing their own thing with it, which is, you know, fair enough what they do. But, I just really wanted to bring Barry's original vision of Peter Pan back, you know.
Is that graphic novel still available? Can people still find that?
It is actually out of print at the moment. It was printed in 2015, and all the copies are sold that were originally printed. But when we actually produced it, I thought some of it needed a bit of tweaking. So we actually managed to get the rights to it back off the publisher.
Right.
Originally, so Finn Cram did all the beautiful colour work on it, and he's other artists that worked on it. So we got the rights to it back just a few years ago, and we've since done all the tweaking that we wanted to do. Sometimes in publishing, there's not time or money enough to do all these things, and you've got a deadline and things, and you know. So it's maybe not even major things that other people would notice, but all the wee niggly things, you know, that we would spot. So we now have a version of it that we think is like the proper, again, it's not like Blade Runner, it's not like there'll be 20 versions.
Right.
But this version, we added 4 pages to it. We reworked the colours and some panels on some pages. The 2015 version, this was one of the problems I had with the publisher, was that we didn't get a proof copy before it went to print. So we never really got to see it before it was printed, and all the colours came out really dark and muddy,
right,
compared to what they should be. A couple of years ago, it was actually printed in Italy in hardback, so there's an Italian version of it. But when that was printed, we'd done all the tweaks. So there's an Italian version out there that is the tweaked one, and all the colours, we got a couple of proofs off the printer before it was all went to print. So it just looks, to be honest, it kind of looks night and day with the UK version. But any future, but we now have the rights to that. We have a print ready book, so that's actually going to be my next thing, is to look for maybe another UK publisher and put out the sort of new version of Peter Pan, all nice and shiny and tweaked, and you know, with the proper colours.
Oh, nice. So, okay.
Yeah, and it's been 9 years now, so another generation of kids, you know. And it's really a book that should always be out. You know, there's always going to be new kids coming out to read it, and it's a story for all ages anyway. You know, it's a lot darker, and there's a lot more to it than, you know, the Disney version. So that's, you just get busy. That's the thing with this business. It's always about the next book. So like, sure. when you're looking back at the last, you know, tweaking the last one or doing something with the last book, it's hard to find the time and stuff. So they get forgotten about a little bit, you know. But all that's done now. It's time to actually find a new home, kind of thing, you know.
So let's take a quick pit stop with Tintin, The Adventures of Tintin. We're not going to do the... This is not a Tintin deep dive podcast, but I've noted 24 albums produced by Hergé between 1929 and 1976, and then there was another posthumous one in 1986.
Yeah, Tintin Elf Art.
That was it, yes.
Yeah, I don't really count that one because it was kind of unfinished. It was... Hershey passed away before it was finished, and it was only partially drawn. When they released it, it was just with like sketches and a lot of text, and so it's not really like the other ones. There was an artist who took it and finished it unofficially, so there's an unofficial version of it out there, but that was something that Hershey strictly, it was forbidden. He actually stated categorically that when he died, he wanted Tintin to sort of end with him. He didn't want anyone else drawing it. That's why we've never had any new Tintin books. In the same way, they've just had like new Asterix books.
Asterix continues, yeah.
Asterix has continued now. I think there's a few new adventures that are not by Goscinny and Uderzo. But Hergé put his foot down with that one. I think he just felt that it wouldn't be his Tintin if someone else ever took it on, you know. So we've got these 20 odd adventures, and that's all you're getting, kind of thing. At least until the, you know, it'll go into public domain in 30 years, and then there'll be a million of them. Because everyone's been dying to do another Tintin adventure, you know.
Sure. And I'm guessing, obviously, you're a big fan of the original 24 books.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love those books. Those books are the main reason I wanted... And like I say, I loved all the Oor Willies and stuff that I found when I was a kid, but the big one that had the impact on me was the Tintin book. I was a goner when I read that. Yeah.
You were committed.
That was it. Yeah, light came on, you know, and that was it. I was going to draw comics.
And when did that light sort of come to bring its spotlight, as it were, or shine on Tara Togs? When did Tara Togs develop?
She came along, I think, about 5 years ago, originally. And I don't really even know where she came from. I'd always wanted to do a... Well, since I was a kid, I'd always actually wanted to draw a Tintin book, a new one. But like I say, when Hergé died, he made it very clear he didn't want that. So you can't do it, you know. I'd even approached, you know, couple of decades ago, I approached the foundation that owned the copyright to Tintin, spoke to them about maybe trying to do another book and stuff. And it's a brick wall. You can't do that. But what you can do is create a new character, and new characters, a new adventure that sort of continues the spirit of it, you know, and visually evokes, you know, memories of it. So that you have a similar experience, but it's also a little bit different, a little bit new as well, you know, and perfectly legal, you know, to do that. There's no copyright issues with that, you know. As long as you don't use his characters or his actual storylines and things, you're fine. So, like I say, I think a lot of Tintin fans would cry out for a new kind of adventure of Tintin, but you can't get one. But, you know, well, here's something a bit similar. You might get the same kind of thrill out of, you know, the same kind of buzz again one last time, you know. So that was kind of the sort of thinking behind it, you know, for me. My other graphic novels have been very different in nature. Like I say, the first one, Milk, was a sci-fi fantasy anthology type thing. I did a little newspaper strip cartoon kind of one. Did a horror, and so when this story came out with Tara Talks, it was just very adventurous, very Tintin-y in nature. So I just thought, well, let's give it that aesthetic, you know, and just go for it, you know.
So the book is called The Silence of the Unicorns, A Tara Togs Adventure. Give us a quick intro. Who is Tara Togs? What's the setting and the character?
Well, it's all based in Scotland.
Right.
First of all, I thought, if we're going to do a Tintin-like book, we'll get rid of, like, the main character as a guy, because there's very few little girl adventurers out there anyway, so we could probably do with another one of those. So she quite quickly became a wee girl. She lives just on the outskirts of Edinburgh. And I thought it'd be quite fun if, unlike Tintin as well, all her adventures would revolve around Scotland and be in Scotland. Because so many things you could sort of do there, you know. Basically, she is an orphan who dreams at the start of the graphic novel. She has aspirations of becoming a photographer, and may or may not do so throughout the course of the story. But she has her dad's camera with her, which is a sort of dear prized sort of possession of hers. And the story's called The Silence of Unicorns, which kind of relates to a famous painting in the story that has been missing. Tara sort of gets involved in the mystery of this. It's a piece of art that's lost, and she gets involved in this sort of conspiracy and art theft kind of story.
And tell us a little bit about how you've laid the book out, because obviously it very much looks like it's in the same mould as the Tintin Adventures. And
Not try to hide that at all. Actually, just wearing that one right on my sleeve. Yeah, just like I said, the story just, it just felt like a Tintin story kind of vibe, you know, sort of a little mystery adventure kind of thing. So I thought I'll just give it that aesthetic, you know. And it just because it suits it, you know, and can give people that little ooh again, you know, love Tintin, you know.
Do you find it easy to put on different styles or different colour palettes like you've done here, choosing the sort of Tintin colour aesthetic?
Absolutely. I work in different styles constantly. If you were to look through my portfolio, you'd see nothing's the same. I never really, something I've not developed as a constant style, which probably comes from my days in the council when I was working on so many different projects. They all required different styles and things. Like I'm saying, from drawing something for, you know, putting your dog poo in the bin and then doing some illustrations for Gold of the Pharaohs, they would want different styles and things. And so I've just applied that to comics as well. I mean, when I worked for DC Thompson, I must have worked in 30, 40 different styles for them. So I'd be jumping from Dennis the Menace to Desperate Dan to Winker Watson to Urwally the Bruins, but drawing them all in their sort of house styles. So my portfolio does look very varied in that respect. And that keeps it interesting for me as well, you know, just the challenge of working different styles, and, you know, you can learn something from each style you're working. The downside to it is I really don't think I have a recognisable style. It's just personal to me. It's maybe a bit of me in all the different styles, but I just tend to think what suits the project, and I'll adapt to that kind of thing. And work on really varied projects, you know. So,
and the Tintin books, and like Asterix, were laid out in that sort of very European album size. Will this be the same?
It'll be exactly the same. Yeah, it will, and it'll be 4 bars per page. It's slightly longer than a Tintin book. It comes out at 66 pages of artwork. Tintin books were always 2, and Asterix were like 48 always. So it's slightly longer, but it does have a prologue and a little epilogue. as well. And people can actually read the prologue on the Kickstarter. It's a 6-page prologue, and that's up there to look at on the Kickstarter. If people out there are interested in seeing what it looks like and getting a little taste of the story, you know.
And that 6 pages, or those 6 pages, are also printed in the current Comic Scenes.
That's right, yes, yes.
Which I've got in front of me, and it looks lovely, although I'm looking forward to seeing it in the full-sized format.
Well, how it all came about, my involvement with the Comic Scene, was I think Tony came up to my house one day to pick up some artwork for something, I think for a little exhibition he was putting on. It was the first time I'd met him, I think, was then. We might have done a little event for him before then. But basically, yeah, so he came up to see me, and I had Tara Togs on the drawing board while I was talking to him. So I was talking to him about it and stuff. And ever since then, he sort of expressed an interest in maybe, you know, doing something like this Kickstarter to get it published. So he's always been very enthusiastic and encouraging, and been behind the character, you know. So for the issue of Comic Scene that came out before the summer one, it's just called Issue Zero. It came out, I think, maybe 3 months ago. He'd actually commissioned a short Tara Togs story. So that was published a few months ago, which actually became the first published Tara Togs story. So it's even out before the graphic novel was. It was a nice way just to, you know, get the character out there. And again, it was another chance to do another wee story set in Scotland. So we did a little... I live in Edinburgh, and one thing that really bugs me as an Edinburgher is this new tourist fad of rubbing Greyfriar Bobby's nose.
Oh, yes, yeah.
When I always got this big golden nose, you know, it just looks kind of silly. And it was never a tradition in Edinburgh, it's just been a new thing. So it was a chance, this short Tara Togs story was a chance for me to actually write about that and get that off my chest. And I wrote a little sort of mystery thing that was revolved around Greyfriars Bobby and how the tourists have sort of affected it and stuff as well was part of the story. So it was a chance to say something, base another little story in Scotland, and put Tara gently out in the world in just a little, you know, 9-page story.
And as you say, so you're working with Comic Scene, Tony Foster, on the Kickstarter. It is, I know, at the time of recording, it's already their most successful Kickstarter they've done, because you were fully funded in 6 hours, I gather.
Yeah, it's amazing. A few years ago, when Shoreline of Infinity took on Milk, my first graphic novel, they also kickstarted it. It's my only other involvement in a Kickstarter. But Milk is not as a commercial a property, I think, as Tara Togs. You know, it was very sort of, it's an anthology, it's all drawn in different styles, it's more adult in nature, just not as commercial, I don't think. So the Kickstarter was successful, but it was one that kind of struggled over the line, you know. So for the month that's out there, you're sort of constantly checking it and, oh God, will it make it, you know. Quite stressful. And then I think on the last day, it made it over the line kind of thing. So all's well that ended well kind of thing. But Tara, it was nice. The pressure was off right away, because like 6 hours later, it was funded. You know, yeah. It was like, oh God, what a relief. And now I think today it's sitting at 310% funded, so it's continuing to sort of grow, you know, so that's awesome.
Yeah, 300% plus, and stretch goals and all that sort of Kickstarter stuff. And yeah. I'm going to put this episode out this Sunday, the 7th, so that gives people until the 18th, so 11 days from this episode.
Yeah, fantastic.
To get on the Kickstarter. And I'll put the link in the show notes and on the website for this episode, Stephen.
Oh, brilliant. That's much appreciated. And like I say, people can check out the 6-page prologue there. So, you know, they can, you know, they don't have to go into it blind. They can have a wee read of it.
They can read that on the Kickstarter page.
Absolutely, yeah.
And if we just do the basic packages, it's £8 for a digital version or £10 plus your postage for a hard copy in the European album format.
Yes, I think that's right. And Tony handles all that side of things.
Sure.
So I'll leave that to him because that's his expertise. And he's just been amazing at running the Kickstarter. Like he's just amazing. So he's so active and just so involved and, you know, posting about things, and it's just been tremendous.
Yes, he keeps regularly updating on the email and so on about Tara Togs.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I've been involved with some bigger publishers. I mean, the one that originally did Peter Pan for me, they were terrible for that. They didn't do anything like that. You know, I think the book was chosen for the First Minister's reading list one day, which, you know, there's only 100 books in the country are chosen for it. So it's quite a big deal, you know.
And
yeah. Dave Gibbons wrote a review of it for that. So it's like a big double whammy, you know, a big name like that reviewing your book for the First Minister's reading list. And that publisher that day decided to tweet about the rugby. okay.
Okay.
So Tony's been just, he's the opposite, you know, he's so on it, it's unbelievable, you know. It's been nice and refreshing for me as well, you know.
Tony has his eye on the ball, but not the rugby ball, thank goodness.
Exactly, yeah. He's got on the right ball, yeah.
So the Kickstarter runs till April 18th. As I say, all the links will be in the show notes for this episode. Get yourself a copy of The Silence of Unicorns, a Tara Togs adventure. I presume there is definitely then a chance of more Tara Togs adventures in the future.
There certainly could be, yeah. I already have a couple of little short stories maybe already worked out. It wasn't really my intention. Like I say, I've always just wanted to do a Tintin book, or Tintin-like book. So when I did it, I wasn't really thinking about maybe doing more, but then I did that little short story for Comic Scene, and another little couple of short stories have just sort of happened. So yeah, there is a potential. And if there was an audience, then why not, you know? So we'll just see. We'll just see what happens, but it's definitely got off to a nice start, you know?
And with the success of the Kickstarter, what will happen afterwards? Is there a chance of getting Tara Togs into bookshops?
I think maybe there is now, because I think originally we'd only budgeted for just getting just a couple of hundred books at the most printed. I think that now it's been so successful, we can maybe exceed that, you know, and there might be a chance of having some surplus books and things as well that we could get out. Or as I say, that's Tony's kind of side of things. I'll leave those kind of things to Tony. But I think that might be a possibility now, you know?
Okay, because I mean, obviously, I presume from the prologue and the Sadal, it's going to be an all ages suitable book, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. 9 to 99.
So hopefully to get it in the hands of some kids' bookshops.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Yeah. It'd be really nice to see it in Waterstones or something, you know. Beside the Tintin Asterix books or something, would be lovely, you know.
Well, if you're looking for a new Tintin book, Tara Togs, The Silence of Unicorns appears to be it.
It's looks... close to Jim, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Hergé is dead, but we have Streff, thank goodness. So.
Well, yeah, it's my homage to the man that really made me want to do all this in the first place, you know. So I hope he'd look at it as a big compliment, you know.
Good. Yes, I hope so too, yes. I'm sure he would. So on the podcast, as you know, we play this Grail page game where we get to choose some pages from the book we're discussing that we'd like to own. Now, obviously, with this book, that would be slightly redundant for you. So what we've decided to do...
I own them all.
You own them all. is, rather remarkably, is to give you the cover, or to give you a pick from the covers of the Tintin albums over the years.
Yeah.
And let you choose one that you would love to own. Now, I'll say in advance, because we've already worked this one out, Stephen, that this is probably the most expensive get round of the Grail Page game we will ever play.
Oh, yeah. This has to be complete fantasy. My pockets don't go this deep.
Yes.
I'm a comic book artist. They don't go very deep at all.
Just to mention that last year, in early part of 2023, the cover artwork for Tintin in America sold for $2.3 million. So...
Yeah, I'll check down the back of my sofa.
Yes.
The thing is going to happen.
We've had some expensive pages, but I think that takes the candle and the biscuit by considerable distance.
Tintin America is the highest selling Tintin book, though, and they're just so famous. They've just sold millions of copies, yeah. You know, in so many languages. You know, they're more than iconic, you know. Ironically, they don't do so well in America, and Tintin in America is the most popular one.
But there you are. You've got 23, I think, or 24 covers to choose from.
God, I'd have, you know...
Which one is it going to be?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I would like Black Island because it's set in Scotland, but Hershey did something very unusual with his cover art. On a few of the annuals. I think on four of them, Tintin has his back to you, which is a big no-no for cover art.
Yes.
Yeah, you never have the character's back. You always have them facing the reader, you know. But on Tintin and the Black Island, the Calculus Affair, and the two Destination Moon and Explorers on the Moon, Tintin has his back to you. So even though it's my favourite actual story, the Black Island, Tintin has his back to you. It's great that he's got a kilt on and all that, but you can't see his face, so I'd probably not actually go for that one. My next choice would probably be Tintin in Tibet, because that was Hershey's favourite story, and it's also one of my favourite stories. But I guess he's got a hat on, so you can't see his famous sort of tuft.
Right.
So I'd probably actually have to either go for Prisoners of the Sun or The Secret of the Unicorn. And I think I'd probably go for The Secret of the Unicorn, basically, because it was the first one that I ever read. And it was the one that really got me into Tintin in the first place.
Well, so, yeah. I did wonder if we were heading there because of, you know, that book in your granny's spare room with the feather bed and the books and the comics.
Yeah, it's got so much nostalgia for me. And as I say, the other tough choice, because Prisoners of the Sun would be my other choice as well. And it was because that was the first one I actually owned myself. I won it off one of my pals at school at Marbles. And so it was like a prized possession of mine, my first Tintin book, even though it was part two of a two-part adventure. And I hadn't read the first part. It didn't matter. You know? Yeah, but I won it off my good pal at Marbles and just treasured it. But I think the other one would just top it. So I'll go for that one.
Okay. Well, as ever, I will post some images on the various social networks when this episode comes out. And, of course, links to Stephen's work and the Kickstarter. And if we ever win the lottery, we've got a very expensive shopping list to go for.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'll start a GoFundMe next so I can get the original Tintin out. No, that's brilliant. That was really good fun. Thanks for that.
Well, as I say, follow the links in the show notes for The Silence of Unicorns, a Tara Togg's adventure on Kickstarter. You've got your own website, which I'll also put a link in the show notes to.
To be honest with you, I don't know if that's live still.
Oh, I found it. Yeah, it still works.
It's still up. Yeah. I haven't done anything with it for so long.
Okay. But there's also @Streff70 on Instagram. Is that the best place to follow you?
I think so. Or Facebook. Tara Togg's has her own Facebook page.
Oh, okay.
Tara Togg's on Facebook. I also TikTok now, with, you know, keeping up with the young ones and stuff like that. I think I'm @Streff70 on TikTok. But mostly I'm of the Facebook generation, so most of my activity online is Facebook. But yeah, Tara's got her own Facebook page. And you'll see on it, I started that Facebook page when I started drawing it So the whole story of how the book came to be is on that Facebook page, from the rough drawings to some partial pages, and just the whole, I sort of kept a diary online. So if you're interested in the book, go to the Facebook page and you can, you know, see the whole story of how the book sort of came together.
Fantastic stuff, Stephen. Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast to tell us about.
That was great fun. I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate that.
No trouble at all. And thank you to Tony Foster for putting us in touch and for organising all the Kickstarter.
Oh, yeah. Guys, diamond. Brilliant.
Yeah. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. As I say, find all of these links, including to all of Stephen's projects, at megacitybookclub.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Mastodon, Blue Sky, and all those socials. Email mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, when we're discussing another great book, probably in a week's time, it's a goodbye from me and...
A goodbye from him.